All right, so I prepared a few transparencies with a summary of the Tribe session. I said a stringy session when we were discussing outside, given the framework here, it's confusing. Summary of the higher PC. Discussion the role of, we'll see what, something happened in between. It's a role of, the role of inhomogeneity, okay? And so, as I said, we heard five speakers, three experimentalists and two theorists, of whom only one is here. And we heard Seamus Davis from Cornell, Suchitra, Sebastian from Cambridge, and John Tranquilla from Brookhaven. The three of them gave us some rather interesting and diverse view on this problem, on the role of inhomogeneity in high-temperature superconductors and similar problems. And then we heard from Una Kim from Cornell, and she's in the audience, and from Matthias Voita from Cologne, who's not here. And I will give my interpretation of what we heard. So I also added a couple of transparencies at the end with data from Basov in San Diego, which I think is highly relevant to all of this. And since that data was not shown in the conference, I will want to show it here. Then after I'm done, Jose Lorenzana will talk about a discussion that took place at this Paris/Florida meeting. I suppose it's somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic where they meet. And so let me summarize in one transparency Seamus's many movies. And I don't know why this thing, please replace the lamp, is still here. I don't know how to get rid of that. But I don't know how to do that. So Seamus showed us STM data in BISCO. And it shows this very interesting dichotomy of having coherent quasi-particle behavior in the low bias regime. In other words, in the regime where the bias is small or comparable to the gap of the superconductor, or somewhat higher than that, but not too much. And they seem to show essentially translationally invariant D-wave coherent behavior. And on the other hand, at high bias, there is no quasi-particle propagation, but instead STM shows local pneumatic slash stripe order with large patches and glassy behavior over long distances. And this is actually quite striking, because if you compare that with data which he didn't show, but it's useful as a comparison, that people have done many years ago in conventional low-temperature superconductors, say in niobium diselenide is a nice example of that, where the high bias behavior is actually looks like propagating Fermi liquid quasi-particles. They don't look, doesn't look like propagating quasi-particles of a superconductor, because they aren't. So there you can see, at least from the sort of STM type perspective, that the high energy state from which the superconductor forms is a conventional Fermi liquid. Here clearly is not, it's something else. So this actually offers a different, a new perspective for why the state from which the high temperature superconductor forms is certainly not a state of weakly coupled quasi-particles. So in addition, one of the things he sees is that at high bias, the regions of high density of states, which is really what he measures, okay, reside on the bonds of the copper oxide lattice, you may say on the oxygens if you wish. In that sense, the point that Steve Kirilson made the other day, that there is no evidence for a Young Rice singlet type behavior, which one might have suspected and people proposed. But Seamus wanted to call the things valence, local valence bonds, in the sense that they look like things that sit where the valence bond would have sat. He has no way of knowing if this is a singlet or a doublet or whatever, given the current data. So I suppose if he had a spin polarized tip or something like that, one could test for that to see whether there is actually a singlet or a doublet sitting on that bond. He cannot, at the moment, the experiment doesn't allow for that. And under please replace the lamp, it says that, you can have to believe me, that he also showed some very interesting data of STM in the nictites, where there is a nice clear evidence of pneumatic order and various people, some of whom are here in the audience, like Subir, have been arguing about that for some time. And I think Steve and his group as well. So this is an interesting new development. He showed this rather quickly. This was his third talk. And I'm not sure if I have summarized all the three talks he gave, but this is a quick summary of the life from a scene from STM.
Going back to Nanda Sonai point, has he ever gone way over on the overdope side? And
Some, but not for the data that he showed. The data he showed essentially looks more or less the same at optimal doping there and in the underdoped. So the difference is that in the underdoped,
whether you get
in the underdoped, he can
the disomnide type, let's say coherent quasi particles.
To go in the overdope, I don't think I have never seen that data. They have data on the essentially the gap maps that goes more or less over into the overdope regime, and you can see that these patches of local superconductivity, so to speak, become more rare as you go into the overdope. But I don't recall seeing that. In a sense, some of that data was shown by Ali Yazdani, who showed that there was some evidence sort of for essentially pairing scale dominated regime in the overdope and coherence suppressed in the underdope. But
well, probably I can add to this. I clearly remember, I mean, this type of stuff pops up in what I like to call mock maps, right? So it's basically this the symmetry of the spectrum. I think a pretty good argument for Anderson telling us that the more asymmetric the spectrum is about mu is zero, or energy zero, the more you have this sort of mock projection. I clearly remember that when you go overdope, he has mock maps, Seamus.
Yes.
And you just see that the contrast is fading. Right?
Yes, but it's still there.
More and more. Now, but the real measure is how asymmetric things are, right?
Right.
And if they're more symmetric, right, I guess you can argue that the effective interaction strength is getting less and it's getting more normal.
Right.
But of course, different from saying that you have really quasi particles, because I haven't quite seen them either in photoemission at high energies in the overdope regime, right? It's more low energies.
Yes.
They can start arguing quasi particles.
I mean, this is a contrast, and I think it's important with more, you know, standard superconductors like that, where you do see clear propagating quasi particles even at the highest.
It'd be nice to see.
Actually, he has a postdoc.
Well, so
who's now working on this direction? So I imagine he may come out with a story.
Yeah. So the data he presented at the meeting were only up to like 89 Kelvin optimal and underdoped side. That's all he presented at the meeting. They are doing measurements in overdoped side.
So
one of the things that happened is the Fermi surface topology changes if you go in overdoped. So there are those.
Well, but aside from that, there is a question where you see coherent quasi-particles at high bias or not.
Yeah, I mean, everybody claims, and I have no difficulty with the notion that it's a Fermi liquid over on the other side. It'd be nice to really.
That has always been an assumption, as far as I know. There is some evidence from STM. The things get sharper there, but it's a matter of, to some extent, it becomes a quantitative issue, is how sharp they become.
But there's this old JC Compensano data, right, which is sort of ignored, I guess, where JC made a case that he tracked the width of the photoemission peaks, and kind of make the case when you go overdope that you can see a line where the width gets less than the energy, so the things turn kind of underdoped, right? And really showing that there's kind of a crossover line.
That's right.
At least when you look at small, higher energies.
Yeah.
I don't see any evidence for a clear.
Well, in these materials, typically, they rarely see peaks that are narrower than the energy.
Yeah.
When they say they are coherent, it's because they are the order of the energy. Typically, they are wider than the energy. So.
Now, this remark that on the bonds, I remember the picture when it's on option, but you said there's no evidence for Rankine singles.
In the sense that things seems to be sitting primarily.
Would it be, how would it look like if it would be single?
Then I suppose the coppers would be bright.
It's tricky, right? I mean,
it is tricky.
It's all started out.
You have an oxygen, but centered on copper, but kind of a ring.
Around the copper, but you will expect to be around the copper.
But it's also that.
If you believe that the dope holes,
an option, then it seems to be an option, but maybe not really some of the bonds, bright and next bonds kind of big and dark, but it should be rather close to some copper, but four bonds sinking out of one copper, maybe. But it's beautiful gold.
Yeah, but here what is actually remarkable is that the high density state doesn't seem to be where the naive argument would suggest.
It's not obvious that it's the same states, right?
Because it's easy symmetry as well.
So you guys
want to say that it's still open to interpretation? I'm happy to hear that, and maybe we'll figure out. Yeah.
It would be on the oxygens, but what he sees is that it's not uniform. It's not
exactly.
Is it that you're not in the? It doesn't look like the dot holes go to the coupers if you want to take a naive.
One argument against Zhang-Wei singlet would be if it is a Zhang-Wei singlet, from the copper side point of view, it will have to be symmetric.
And it's not.
Cross of right.
Correct, and it's not.
But we show from analyzing the data that it is not.
Okay, so I think maybe one should not draw.
It is one sort of separate thing, Eduardo, which was not on the program. And I find it, really very interesting, and that is this latest thing of Zhi Shen, and I guess he's living a life with it at all kinds of meetings, where he shows that when you warm up things and you get above T star, and you look in the Antonov regime, you get sort of this narrowing of all latency of states, and you get sort of still quite broad, but dispersive feature, which is like the LDA band. And then you cool down in the solar underdump system, and you find that this balance out in this extremely incoherent blob of stuff sitting at the antinodes.
Maybe one day next week you can show us the data and we can discuss it.
I think it's something. My take on that is that Seamus has been running around for a long time now with the story that the antinodes are about these stripy things.
Yes.
And there's always a photo emission, no relation. Between this and what they saw.
I don't think this is. I'm going to come back to that. Maybe we can discuss it in a moment when I talk. Because I'm going to talk about the LBCO, where this is important.
Specifically, address this exaggeration finding.
So what
the deal is that you get order, and we have all learned to do artifact calculations, and you would expect this order that you get more coherence, that the passive particles would get better behaved. But you see just qualitatively exactly the opposite, that when the stripe order develops, right, that the spectral wave spreads out, especially in energy.
Yeah, but in BISCO, but remember that in BISCO there is no long range order. In BISCO, this is only, you're looking at just high energy correlations here. You're not looking at static order. This is just high energy behavior.
Get the static stripe patterns in
the low energy physics.
Without static order, give me the theory. You have to go beyond
static
theory.
There is static order.
There is static order.
The sides are non-equivalent.
The sides are non-equivalent. This is true, but it's not. It's not that you see. Okay.
That's static order.
Yeah.
It's static order.
It's static order. Come on.
But the static order that is only apparent at high energies. So in some sense, at low energies, is superseded by the uniform component of the wave super.
No, you measure this with electrons, and electrons can just not pick up this translational order.
Okay, well, I'll come back to that in a moment when I talk about the stripe superconductor, which is another part that people discussed. Okay, so Suchitra showed us the quantum oscillation experiments in YBCO and the mixed phase of YBCO at low temperatures and high fields. She showed us that there are multiple frequencies, and these frequencies don't seem to be simply related to each other by harmonics. And so she therefore concluded that this probably came, if you take a Fermi surface or quasi-particle picture, that the Fermi surface somehow has been folded, and then there is some then there is a question how you interpret that. So one possibility of this reconstruction of the Fermi surface is to explain it in terms of some sort of stripe, some sort of static stripe phase at high fields of the type, say for example, that calculations tip of the type that Norman and Millis have discussed, or perhaps the density wave that Chakravarti and collaborators discuss as well.
In that context, did she talk about the absence of Zeeman splitting?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
That's completely true. Yeah. To you. You understand that completely, or some discussion?
Well, let's have
it.
So what was discussed? What was she said?
That's not, I mean, she did mention that. She said that these are the two sort of main possible interpretations of this. But
once you look at the absence of Zeeman splitting, it clearly picks out spin density.
That's my interpretation too. She wanted to be a little more ecumenical, I think, and give.
He said if it were to be DDW, it will have to be triplet time.
Correct. And it's not.
That's what she said.
And it's not.
That is so complicated.
Correct. But she didn't come down to say this is actually giving you.
So, is there a paper on that, or is that paper out?
Not as far as me. Not as far as I know.
It started physics. It was like as if it was something new, right?
Yeah. I don't think there is a paper. I haven't seen it, at least. So the other thing that is, I think, important is that this result, at least seen from this point of view, is consistent, namely from the spin density wave point of view, is consistent with the neutron scattering experiments of Hinkoff at low, essentially much lower magnetic fields, where you see essentially a static spin stripe state, or whatever you want to call it.
But it's not that much lower, it's 15 Tesla.
And the other is 40, okay, it's much lower. It's done in different laboratories for the reason, and these days it's still called lower fields. But Hinkoff actually, they see that even for very low fields. So it's not that they see that only for 15 Tesla. So the weight actually extends to low energies, and they actually pick it up at lower fields as well. So there is a question to my mind, which I will want to come back in a moment, is whether this is related to the stripe phase that is seen in LBCO, whether these are different beasts or they are the same. And so we'll come back to that in a moment.
Did they say these are old pockets or
Well, there was a discussion on that too. She wanted to have an electron pocket in the antinode, and that seems to be at variance with the with ARPES, as far as I know.
Very confusing.
There's no ARPES at 60
Tesla. No, I know. So then there is a question: how you interpret this? And
how you interpret what?
Well, whether or not there should be a hole pocket, an electron pocket at. In the antinode or not. Certainly in ARPES, there isn't, because of course ARPES is zero field. So you cannot.
Argument with ARPES is that the gap is so much larger than the field,
right,
the antinode region.
Right. That you will not expect that those magnetic fields, the things will change dramatically. So that's the question. So. Okay, so let me now go over Tranquada's talk again very quickly. So he showed us neutron data and transport experiments in LBCO near 1/8, near the 1/8 anomaly. And he showed these rather dramatic experiments that they show this phenomenon of dynamical layer decoupling well above the TC, where the system behaves as a three-dimensional superconductor in the sense that you get a Meissner state. And in this intermediate regime, up to temperatures of the order of 18 Kelvin or something like that, depending on the sample, they show essentially evidence for 2D Costal-Stavros-like superconducting order in the planes, while at the same time being insulating along the C-axis. And so essentially from this behavior appears to set in below the spin ordering temperature, which is something like 42 Kelvin, and the in-plane fluctuations become very strong below that point, and you get two-dimensional superconducting-like behavior below 18. And meanwhile, you see the C-axis resistivity continues to rise as you lower the temperature. Now, in the same regime, and this is important, I think one needs to keep this in mind, ARPAs, and actually there is excellent ARPAs data, first from Tony Wallace in group in Brookhaven, and more recently from the CX's group, which has a high resolution. They show a large and unsuppressed antinodal gap and D-wave behavior throughout this regime. And this is actually quite important. So it shows that somehow the system, you have a coexistence of both behaviors in the system. So you have a large antinodal gap that you can call it a rich, and I like to think of that as a high pairing scale in a sense, and having at the same time a strong static charge order, both charge, spin, and superconductivity in the planes. Okay? So this actually raises a number of important questions. How can you get this to this effective decoupling? You would normally expect to have some C-axis Josephson effect to exist, and this appears to be absent, at least above the Meissner state or above the place where rho c goes to zero, certainly. And where Erzberg and collaborators, which includes me and John and Una and Steve and various others, we proposed that this phenomenology could be explained in terms of a state which we abused a name that already existed called the pair density wave state to mean a state in which charge, spin, and superconducting orders are all get striped. And so in other words, they don't compete, but they get intertwined. So instead of thinking of them as competing orders, when one order suppresses the other, they all essentially rise together. So this seems to be, in some sense, the quote, competing state has actually a superconducting character. Otherwise, all of this would have been absent. So which was the assumption we all made a long time ago, that superconductivity simply competes with this and kills the charge order kills the superconducting behavior. This actually is a clear contradiction with that. So there is a question, how generic is this type of phase, and how this is related with the other sightings? Yes.
Yeah. Doesn't that have a firm surface?
It does.
But in the
ARPAs, there isn't. I know, and this is actually a problem, and this is something needs to be understood. So this actually will have pockets.
Can you
see it as a firm surface? Has pockets, like all density wave states.
And it's a superconductor.
It's a superconductor with pockets. It doesn't have a fully gapped Fermi surface.
Just because you break translations.
Right. You have that.
It doesn't have a cube.
So there is a question, there is an issue whether the resolution of ARPAs can resolve that, can tell you. So it's a question of how much spectral weight there is, whether ARPAs is maybe confusing that with a node, or whether it's a true node. But it's true, and we have checked that in our calculations, that if you have a coexistence between this state and a uniform D-wave, you do get nodes. But then you kill the decoupling. Okay. So
it's also strange with the ARPAs that the nodes seem to be exactly along this.
Whereas you will expect by symmetry, and by symmetry you should have shifted because you have a broken. Yeah. Yeah. But remember that this is a DLTT structure, so the different layers alternate.
But the nodes.
But one node shifts up, the other one shifts down, so maybe they are seeing some average. Who knows? So I don't know. So the question is how generic this is, and so for that reason I'll come back later and show some data from Basov's group, which I think is quite relevant to this.
Kind of related question to these variances or whatever. So Seamus is making his own case, right? That you have this nodal protectorate, that mirror nodes,
right.
You have these beautiful particles or
particles.
Is that something you can argue in the case of this pair density wave?
No. As I said, if you do calculations, if you do naive calculations of the pair density wave, and you couple that to quasi-particles, you do get pockets. You don't get nodes. You don't get nodes. No, we wrote a semi-review paper about a few months ago, and we showed what the spectral functions look like, and they do have pockets. So. So that's clear.
Okay. You're not thinking on that on something generic. I mean, you're thinking on that specifically for 1.8. Yeah?
Well, there is a question. Okay, that's how we started thinking about that. But I'm going to show you some data now from Basov's group that suggests that this is actually maybe more general behavior than we thought. I mean, I have always thought that you could get stripes, and the stripes were part of the story. It is a matter of personal belief, I guess you may call it. So this is what I think. So in principle, you could have a mechanism out of that. But this type of state suggests that the superconducting state that you get is a little more elaborate. It's not just simply coexistence or competition between the two states, but more that they're actually coming together. That the non-uniform state actually has a superconducting character itself. And this is something that the standard stripe models don't have. So, and I think it's important. The fact that this is static is peculiar to 1/8 because of the
decoupling of the layers.
The layer decoupling, no. I'm going to show data from Basov. That's why I want to show the data. Okay. So let me go over quickly, maybe Una being here and being, you know, feel embarrassed giving a talk of her talk. But she actually gave, in some sense, three talks as well as, I think this is a requirement in Cornell, that you give three talks. Though two of her talks were quite a bit shorter, so, and I changed the order of what she discussed. She showed data, an analysis of the STM data that she has been doing with Michael Lohler and I guess with Jim Sefner as well, about doing new interesting tests for nematicity, essentially. And the main result is that the high bias STM data shows nematic order on length scales which are much longer than the translational stripe order, which is actually quite short. It's only a few lattice spacings. And she has very beautiful pictures that shows that the nematic order appears to be as large as the patch, as the field of view that Seamus is actually showing. So I will not elaborate a lot on that. You can talk to Una since she's here. And that seems actually, that's for me, it was quite interesting to see, because I always thought there will be more or less, maybe there will be a factor of two difference, but the difference is actually quite significant.
Yeah, I like to see this. Best evidence we have for nematic order, right? I mean, there's also Keimer.
There is Keimer, yes.
So it's serious, but there's this worry that you have already broken.
Right. Well, because you need to have something that gives you some orientation and order to begin with, which are the chains in that case. But here, essentially, this is more patchy, but over a very long length scale. I think that's very important. That,
just to be fair, though, we only looked at one data set.
Okay.
And so what I think is maybe a better way to characterize what we've done is just to propose a definite order parameter that can be easily measured in STM to really pin down whether or not the statements you've made in this slide are true.
Okay.
It's not, I wouldn't say that we now have the best evidence for nematic in BISCO yet.
Well, we didn't have any so in this before, so now this is the best one since the only one. But on the other hand, I think I agree with you, it would be better to see how generic these results are. And so you are thinking that maybe you landed in a happy patch that...
I don't know, right?
Okay, so...
You were told that the discovery hasn't been made
discovery
yet.
Hasn't been made yet.
The discovery, not until you publish it in Science, I suppose. Otherwise you have no right to call it a discovery. So the other thing that is important is that there is a strong energy dependence in the nematic order, in order setting more or less where quasi-particle propagation stops being observable.
The example is like the observation of the nematic order by electrons, right?
I mean,
you don't know what we're doing. I thought like a simple one-to-one relationship between...
Yeah, but the fact that this has a strong energy dependence is indicative that this is an ordering effect.
In a way that is very strong energy dependent.
Well, but that means it's an ordering effect. It will be very nice and important to have a picture of that as a function of temperature and doping as well, to make sure that this actually, in that sense, is clearly a correlation effect, and clearly has to be.
No doubt about it, I don't really agree, but I think that there is a bit of a debate, but I think the majority is thinking that you have to step excite order at the surfaces, and it's picked up by SDS, and then you probe it through these electrons, and then a pretty wild life, a pretty complicated life, and some electrons don't see it, and other electrons see it times through asymmetry in a kind of unexpected thing. I don't know if this is really a theme of discussion or not. I mean, you might say, I don't believe that there's static order, but then I would like to hear reasons, right?
Well, there isn't, no, okay, there, okay, one of the reasons obviously is disorder, because this type of order couples strongly to random fields, which is which are disorders here, and then you, in other words, this actually will tend to be glassy in general over long scales.
So that's more like static, right? It's really static.
Right. Yeah. So, but it's local order over long scales, and that's what this is.
Okay. So there we go.
So the other two talks that Una gave, I just give them the titles more or less. One was on the effects of quantum critical pneumatic fluctuations on the low energy quasi-particle behavior as seen by STM, and I don't think I'm going to discuss in detail, or I'm not going to discuss it, just simply mention it. And she also gave some interesting arguments of some recent work that she has done with, again, with Michael and with Kai Sun, on a theory of the role of pneumatic order in the incommensurate in elastic peaks that are seen in neutron scattering, which they posted recently. Yes.
Well, I'll just ask Una. Yes, can you tell the difference between charged pneumatic and spin pneumatic? I missed the conference, so I'm not sure.
So the main point of this measure was that it's a measure that is translational symmetry preserving and just detecting the rotational symmetry breaking.
What do you mean by charged pneumatic and spin?
But you're talking about this part of the, this part? Well, you're looking at STM, so you're looking at the charge sector.
So the data we applied, the observable tool is STM, which is not spin resolved. But generally the idea is if you have a scalar quantity that you're measuring as a function of position, and you can Fourier transform it, and you have a Bragg peak, and then you can use that Bragg peak to study the rotational symmetry breaking. That was the main idea.
All of this discussion here is for charged pneumatics.
If this was for charged pneumatics.
Yes. Which I think what you call spin pneumatic is something completely different, which is not.
This is not here. Oh, yeah, and it's not a spin pneumatic.
Spin pneumatic is...
It's done in the sense that it breaks the rotations, the symmetry of rotations in real space, not in spin space.
Yeah, no, but you can break both, right?
Well, that too. You can have a pneumatic spin pneumatic, but that's a different subject.
Yeah,
you can. Matthias Wojta gave us a different perspective. He gave a detailed description of the mean field theory of a bond center stripe phase coexisting with a uniform D-wave superconductor. He made the point that this was, in some sense, phenomenological, as it wasn't self-consistent, but he showed how a theory of this type can describe the STM data and the ARPES, particularly the ARPES data, in some detail. The state has no quasi-particles, provided the stripe order is not too strong, and otherwise, of course, it doesn't. The theory with the D-wave has some sort of, in my interpretation, has some sort of D-wave pneumatic-like order parameter in the sense that has a staggered bond order that changes sign under a 90-degree rotation. So in that sense, it has a pneumatic character as well, although it's staggered. So that's a feature of the type of state that he described. I think it's something he did with you originally. Well, it's an elaboration of that, I suppose.
This is
probably
the point three.
Right, this is new. Okay. Then he talked about the effective field theory of the state and the quantum critical behavior. And then finally, he addressed the possible connection between this type of order and what and the layer decoupling effect, in the sense that when they take one of these states, the stripe bond order does lead to a conceivable suppression of the C-axis Josephson effect, but it's only very large or significant if the stripe order is strong. So I don't know how strong you can make it without ruining the nodal quasi-particles. which is actually the main point of this argument, is that they had no Delogossi particles. My impression is that if you really want to explain from here the layer decoupling at the scale that is seen in the experiment, you probably will not predict that have no quasi particles.
So the competing explanation is your D wave for the first, but that doesn't even have no quasi particles.
No, I know. So this is a question. The problem is how do you explain, it's an open question how you explain the quasi particles as seen in ARPES in the same data, in the same regime. There are actually other tests, for instance, of the pair density wave idea. One is that if you there is this interesting relationship between the ordering wave vector of the charge and spin, they differ by a factor of two, which is a characteristic of this state. If you have a uniform D wave component of the order parameter, that relationship breaks, and then you get a density wave of the same ordering wave vector as everybody else without the factor of two. These experiments have not been done, and Abamonte is searching for that, well, or will search for that when he gets beamline time, to look at essentially in the Meissner state of LBCO to see whether this is seen or not. So that will be a way to at least falsify the pair density wave idea, in the sense that if it doesn't show there, what we know is that there is data, X-ray scattering data from the Toronto group. This is Kim, I forgot his first name, John Kim, where what he sees is that as the superconducting transition is approached, the intensity of the 2Q peak in the charge density wave actually goes down. And so that presumably means that it has to go up somewhere else. Whether it's going up at Q instead of 2Q is still an open question, since the people have not searched for that. But that will be a way of, if you want to kill the pair density wave idea, that's a way to do it, or confirm it. So let me give a rundown of my interpretation of what we saw. In my mind, the LBCO experiments lead to a new perspective on the role of charge order in these systems, in the sense that if one believes that this state is a little more general than in 1/8, then the pair density wave certainly explains these effects, in particular the dynamical layer decoupling, as a consequence of the symmetries of the state. And the fact that LBCO shows strong stripe order with a large pairing scale suggests that the mechanism behind this order is actually related to the overall mechanism of ITC and not divorced from that. So this is not a, in that sense, you could say that these observations, including the fact that it's a high pairing scale, suggests that this is not a, how to say, a sideshow to the main problem, but is part of the same problem of explaining ITC in the first place. To some extent, this is in a sense, is a question of what happens if you have a system with a very high pairing scale, you may end up with an inhomogeneous superconductor. So having a high pairing scale alone is not sufficient to raise TC. Okay, in this case, you end up with an overall TC, which is actually quite low.
It makes the superfluid density problem worse.
Yes, and that's what happens here. From the antinodal gap. If you take the point of view, the antinodal gap measures the pairing scale. Is actually, in a sense, is highest there.
It's higher than this core, or what?
No, in that material, in LBCO.
If you take LBCO, then in this core.
No. In LBCO, as a function of X, it's either depending which group you believe, which ARPES group you believe. If you believe the Brookhaven group, it's actually highest at 1/8. If you look at the Stanford data, it's essentially more or less constant, maybe rising as slightly as you lower the doping, as you go to lower doping. But it's certainly not suppressed as you go through the 1/8 anomaly. Okay, so it has a high pairing scale in that sense. So this, in a sense, is an interesting issue to think about, because the size of the pairing scale alone doesn't guarantee to have a high TC or a high critical current. Okay. Then the other question is, how generic is this type of order? And let me show you some data from the San Diego group. This is Basov's group. They do Josephson resonance experiments. They have studied that in LSEO and LNSEO. but no one has done this in the field as a function of magnetic fields. So let me show you two slides from them. The things were shown in the March meeting by Shafkans, who's a student of Basov. And so this is a plot. This is what Basov and company called this universal C-axis plot. I'm not sure if I will want to use the term universality, but it maybe is generic. The term universality is largely abused in this field. And, so this is the C-axis penetration depth, or the superfluid density in a sense, as a function of, underneath we place the lamp, is the residual C-axis conductivity as extrapolated to zero temperature from the data above TC. And so it shows this.
Edward, I'm not quite sure.
Yes, it's sigma 1C. Okay. I'm reading it.
Well, at zero, the TC.
At TC, so this is the extra, yes, at TC. This is the one at TC. So this is in, so there is a law of this type. This is a log-log plot. It's a law of this type that certainly holds for BCS, for low-temperature superconductors, but also holds for the majority of the high-temperature superconductors. And here there is a list of them where this data essentially is satisfied within some error bars. And what they have done is to, so this goes back to some work of Basov's of 1994 and more recently 2002. So they have actually other data that involves, you know, niobium and essentially all of the superconductors more or less obey this law. Okay.
What replaces the C-axis conductance? You can put any conductance. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Well, they look at the change in their spectral weight, and from there they extrapolate, they extract this quantity.
This is
sigma 1C. Essentially, is the conductivity at
zero frequency, or at some?
At some, well, this is the it comes from the optical conductivity. That's what he does. Okay.
That's how I can read it, as when the sample becomes more metallic along the C-axis,
yes,
I have a higher superfluid density.
Density, that's what I mean.
And I was, you know, astonished. I would have expected that.
So this is a straight line essentially is an expression that you get from BCS, yeah. And essentially satisfied by pretty much all superconductors. And what they showed in the match meeting, and this is the data I wanted to flash here, is the same, but now you apply a magnetic field, a perpendicular magnetic field. And here, and I have a problem because I'm colorblind, so I'm not sure what is the difference between these two colors. I can read the labels, but not the colors. So that's a bit of a problem. So this is lanthanum strontium copper oxide, this LBCO, and this is the niobium material. At zero field and as a function of field, LBCO, I believe, is this stuff here, which means that they cannot measure it. They cannot measure the C-axis Josephson resonance from optical conductivity. So this is another way of saying they see the dynamical layer decoupling. It's the same effect. And here what they see in lanthanum strontium copper oxide, is it the same color as that?
Yep.
So for depending what the field is, then you get a larger effect. So for instance, this is at zero field, and then as a field of 8 tesla, it goes up to that.
All below HC2.
This is all below HC2. So it's in the same regime where Bela Lake saw the field-induced density wave. It's in the mixed phase, if you wish. It's a few tesla. This is eight, so you say it's pretty much, if you look at the old Bela Lake data, it's about in those fields.
So you expect some decrease in theory, so is this large compared to what?
It is, no, but it's large compared to the error bars that essentially define this line. So in a sense, in other words, for all of the superconductors in general, when you get you pretty much they all lie here, but as soon as you begin to get any sort of striping of this type, well, striping of some sort, they seem to violate this law.
Are they following sigma 1C? I don't understand. Why should sigma 1C have anything to do with the field induced?
Because if you think that this is, well, first of all, this is the same effect that is seen here. What this is suggesting is that the field-induced spin density wave is also superconducting. and it's a relative of the LVC oscillator.
I'm not arguing with that. I just want to know what should I think that change is big. It has no...
Well, essentially, by the way, it's big in the sense this is a lower bound. It means by 8 Tesla they cannot measure it. This is the lower bound that they have.
It's off scale.
It's off scale.
It's 100.
Right.
So I get it, guys.
Right. It's no longer measurable. By the time they go very far away from this 1/8 regime where they see these effects, essentially they see small effects due to magnetic fields. So there's a change in...
That's also 8
Tesla? Yes, it's all 8 Tesla. So the point is that this seems to correlate with the onset of some sort of stripe order, whether it's spin or charge or both. So what this is suggesting is that even these older data, in other words, these spin density wave type states, perhaps have the same character as the LVC.
Why isn't it just vortex lattice physics?
Why will that give you a layer decoupling? Normally, you will still have a GCF St. Joseph effect.
Basically, my question.
But I think it's the small size of the effect.
That's more strongly coupled. I mean, the question of when, as you go up the field, you decouple the layers.
But in essence, it's essentially the same effect in that these onsets are where this anomaly appears to be strongest.
Well, striking is a dopamine effect.
Yes.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying the effect.
Yes.
Could be understood, I think, more generally. But you're saying in this case, it corresponds to the same conditions under which...
Right, so...
It's a little tricky, Mac. Ordinarily, the field on the AB plane...
Right, this is serious.
...you argue that really will decouple these Josephson junctions. But you put it on this plane... It shouldn't do so much, and it should be more like...
I mean, I sort of forgot what those phase diagrams look like, but all these lines come down.
One of the things we should do is to ask Dimitri to come down and give a talk on this.
We asked him. He's in Germany.
That's okay. So I couldn't resist but to show this, since I think it's relevant to what we saw in the conference, and this data wasn't shown there.
There's a lot that he has done for this.
Oh,
I think that's quite striking.
Yeah.
I'm also surprised, right? Because the big deal is, of course, the neodymium system, right?
This is one of them.
Lady coupling system, but then I learned that lanthanum barium is nearly like that.
Yes.
LVT. And there are also lanthanum strontium around 1/8.
Yes.
That is sort of this incipient LTT, and it doesn't quite make it, you know, and might be glassy.
Well, LTT. I'd love to see someone do, but this hasn't been done, this type of experiments in YBCO at 6.45, where, you know, now neutrons cut. There is no LTT there because you don't have a
frustration effect.
But you still will get. If you have stripe order, so for some reason you do get stripe order, just by Coulomb interactions they will get shifted by one period from one layer to the next, and that actually does lead to a frustration of the Josephson effect.
But it's not as absolute.
It's not as strong. So we show that in our review. So the question is, if you believe that this state is more generic, there are ways to test it. So I would say that these are suggestions that this state may be present.
You could turn this around, the vortex physics question, and say the degree to which they think they know where all these decoupling lines come, if you have this stripe frustration or the symmetry cancellation of the...
of the Josephson effect,
then it shouldn't work there. It should be different.
Yes.
And that would be... another way of getting at it, in which you look at both effects, and it either is where it should be or it isn't.
So let me say that there is no microscopic basis for what I'm saying. The question is, people have tried, and Doug has tried, and various others. We have some ideas about why this state could exist, but there isn't really a good microscopic theory of what this state should be. This is like a Larkin-Ovchinnikov state without the magnetic fields. In a sense, it's self-generated. So this is an open question.
Well, in some ways, Dimitri is the pro, but my sense is it's not easy to measure lambda c. It might be easier to look at the vortex phases.
Okay, so this is the end of my presentation. Jose will continue.
I'd like you now to give this a good end. Yes. Are you unanimous that you all believe that pseudogaps that are coming from private cities? Is there anyone saying, no, I don't believe that?
I think data you'll see from some of the Monte Carlo calculations made on systems because of the boundary conditions that don't have the stripes. Mm-hmm. And let's show a pseudo gap in the area. Mark could comment on that. But I think there's numerical evidence that you can have a pseudo gap effect appear more coming out of a muck-like behavior of some type or anti-ferromagnetic pattern, but without the stripes. And so, while I think it's appealing to it's have more, only one like, explanation,
yeah, it's fine. I mean, in theory, there are all kinds of possibilities, right? But it's more like there's an experimental situation. Yeah. We look at it. And personally, I have kind of a hard time doubting that, at least. What SDM and ARCUS are seeing, that it can mean anything else that you're just
right. So let's go on the temperature scale, yeah. Because I think a lot of this is happening.
But other people here.
I'm not sure we're passing around. It seems to me that we have to look at the temperature scale on which it's happening, because I can well believe down at lower temperatures, we're dealing with the effect of stripes. But when we go up towards T star, you presumably have a large region which is named pseudo gap. Now, what the effects are, I don't know, but it's not clear to me that the stripes signify T star. T star seems much too.
You just say spin density of order is. Do you put that in stripes or not? Fluctuating
in
density of order.
Would
that be a
strength
to you?
Well, I mean, we have a stripe since we see it.
You know,
that is
the reason. You need the
microphone. I don't know.
But in any case, we have the same order parameter. Since
right, so that's what I... So I'm trying to understand what where you draw your boundary and what is a stripe and what is not.
I mean, like, for me, they are the same. It's a matter, it's a quantitative issue. When
yeah,
matching
okay.
The other, but they have the same order parameter, and they may even have similar dynamics.
And you mentioned, local antiferromagnetism. So is that... If it becomes incommensurate, isn't that the same thing as what they're saying?
Question for you. These stride fissures are much more clearly seen as around 1/8. There is anomaly in GC, really. Would you expect something seen also in G-star, like some maximum of G-star around 1/8?
I guess I. There is something that is seen in the. What do you call it? Not quite at 1/8, but very close.
I guess, Michael's perspective is, I think, very close to Doc's that, when you go above T star, I don't think there's any evidence for any stuff of the kind. There are kind of high temperature neutral scattering measurements, and all these beautiful incommensurate fluctuations just disappear. They're not there. But then you go through T star, and my take on it is like you tend to start forming pairs there, you tend to start to organize your antiferromagnetism there, you cool down further, these things interact strongly, and when they come to a standstill, they really want to form these more structured stripe patterns instead of some, fetchy two subplanets antiferromagnets. I don't think we agree.
So
the star is really, rather unrelated to the translation symmetry breaking.
I'm surprised as you go through.
Could there be a maximum, like the same as minimum of TC at 1/8? Could there be a maximum of T star at 1/8?
No,
because that's, for that the lattice is not very important, apparently, and we don't see it.
Okay.
I mean, this was actually the assumption that if the things are connected, then probably the scale itself will come down. But here what happens is that there's a three-dimensional TC. But not the superconductivity itself, in a sense.
That's what this LBC
18. No, but in a sense, actually, 18 is an effect of commensurability.
Well, it's also an effect of the filtering of the oxygen.
Right, right. But if it is indeed important for all these crises, and if this part could be connected with that, I would expect also that it should be also felt somehow in the staff.
No, here, I mean, at this time, indeed.
This isn't precisely the point of this data. It shows that if you end up with a system where the superconductivity has also this triad character, then you get the suppression of the three-dimensional TC, and while keeping essentially the Turing scale more or less unchanged.
Insensitive to doping. That's my question.
Yeah, essentially
different. This task scale should be sensitive in some sense to this commensurability or completely insensitive.
It's essentially insensitive. It seems to increase slightly without the light.
Yeah. So the other side of it is, when you look in neutron scattering data at these high temperatures, then you find that typical correlation length get really quite short. In other words, the system should care less about commensuration effects there, right? Because it's just loosely hanging together. And you just shouldn't think recoupling theory.
So we're looking for the Linux
Sorry. Okay, doesn't matter. Well, I can just.
You want
you
to?
Want to discuss something?
As you.
What I did was to lead this discussion about stripes, and the idea was to see what we discussed before. I mean, whether stripes and Fermi liquid-like or nodal quasi particles are compatible.
So this is in the Paris.
In the Paris meeting, yes. And what I wanted to do is a bit to provocate people that were there. And the first thing I did is to show a very old data by CX Shen. You remember this data from the Science paper 99 with So, in which he showed this nice Holy Cross.
Is the hope that the computer will work, or have we given up?
I don't know.
I give up.
Turn it back on.
It's coming back up.
Yeah, it is there, but I don't manage to. Well, I can.
Is it? It's just not seeing the VGA.
Or? Is that not seeing the? What is? Something happened?
It did something.
It says adjusting, I don't know what.
It's.
Maybe the thing was boosting.
I can do it. If somebody has a pen, a memory pen, a memory stick.
Yeah.
Can you give me a flash disk?
Yeah. Any memory? I can USB memory. Yes. Can I use? That's a USB memory?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it can be inserted in both ways, so one is correct, you can try it.
Maybe I should take the time to say, if we're going to dinner
yes.
at 6:30, at Madame Lou's, the question is,
you need to be there at 6:30.
We need to be there at 6:30. We have no time problem. The problem we have is transportation, and are people comfortable with possible transportation now?
back and take...
I can take four or five of the three ones in the back seat. How do you spell Madam Lou? Sorry.
Madam Lou's...
It's
State Street
Market.
It's
3-5. Wow, it's even Street my screen.
Oh, no. And that's at 6:30, you said?
Yeah. Sorry, 3524, and somehow this is a little
farther.
And Lord Armchair. And this is Upper State, so it's not downtown.
It's near La Cumbre. It's across the street from La Cumbre Shopping Mall. Would you take the exit off La Cumbre?
I think you won't have,
And then turn right.
Going towards downtown, but it's a couple of blocks from there.
Okay, so they're on La Cumbre and then towards downtown. But
yeah, it's very close to them.
We can make more reservations. I think I made it for 12, and then when I looked around, we somehow we found it down to 10, I think, but we can have more. So the real question is, do you have lines? I'm writing with Mac.
I don't have a car.
I have a car, but I don't yet have permission. And we all.
That's more important than the other car.
And everybody who's married understands exactly what I mean. We could take two others.
Okay.
If we go.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay,
so here, Edward. Yeah.
I also
have a car. Okay, you have a car?
I
okay. So, I'll take those four then.
I need a special arrangement.
6:30.
Yeah, but we leave here at 6:50.
We leave here at 6:50.
Well, first of all, I need to ride my bike home just along the way, and I need to catch people somewhere.
Okay, just on
your way. I'll tell you. Very
quickly. Yeah, I cannot resist. There's still wrestling. I'm getting his machine going.
This
day of ICH for those who have never seen it. And all they really do is this is sort of totally underdogged booklet. And then you have this generic, very fat, incoherent block of spectral lay sitting. At the end of notes, right, and I can hope that you see that a fast particle pops up here and you're going to this fully stay. That is that situation. And a drawable scale, I was so impressed that, you know, I just read it by heart. And then the great surprise is when you heat this up to temperatures of order T star, there's lots of narrows and they can track then what is above the thermal energy because of the thermal factors. And they see a fairly, well-defined band. It's just like the LDA band.
What's the world are you drawing? I'm sorry.
Famous for no singularity.
What was behind the screen when you first started to draw that for me? That's why I moved over here.
What's wrong? I guess it's K versus omega.
This is A, this is enternode, this is omega, this is fermi. So this is a spectacular narrowing effect where you raise temperature. Well, my take on this is that any attempt to do field theory is bound to fail, right? Because in field theory, when you would have relatively well established space-time order, then you would find all the sharp mass particles in you. So sort of the exodus continuum can be explained by thinking that you're sort of a spectral gap. Version of this band feeding the star potential. So the fact that you have this whole smear going down to low energies that is so incoherent, it has been very hard to explain as any, theory we have at the moment. My take on it is like, you have this weird normal state, it's still there at high temperatures, about to start in an unknown regime.
Jan, can we let him do his talk?
Yeah, I am one second. I think this is extremely important data. You might know about it. If not, you're going to listen because it's
important. I know, but he was supposed to. You know.
Yeah, no, but this is just a second. One can never tell something.
Never? Okay, go
on. Yeah. Tell me,
right?
I think it's your other stuff. Okay. Snoopy.
Okay, sorry about that, about the these computers. Trust too much in Linux. So these were the questions we put there. How can inhomogeneity stripes and checkerboard glassy states coexist with LDA like Fermi surface or with coherent noble states, which you see in Potomitian, so what we were asking before. Another question related is, are surface probe like Potomitian STM and neutron seeing the same thing? So this tried to be provocative questions to stimulate the audience there. Next question was, are time scale important in order to explain coexistence of fermiology and stripes? And there is whether one can think that below some coherence scale there is a Fermi liquid like behavior, and above some this coherence scale you see things which look more stripey like. So is it possible that stripes are part of the incoherent part of your spectral function? Then we also discussed about quantum oscillations. There was Cyril Proust, which was one of the organizers of the conference, and there were people which somehow talk about that, about related things, in particular induced order by magnetic field during the conference. And also whether glassy physics can be related to this fact that there were some contributions by Steven, by Kivelson and Matt Granath about this, how with glassy physics and stripes you can get things which look more or less like LDA Fermi surface. So these were the questions, and let me start by the end, which are the quantum oscillations. So here, I talked privately with Cyril Proust, and he said, "Oh, I know if you try to make a discussion about that, people will say that this is magnetically induced. I don't think this is a reconstruction of the Fermi surface, but I think it's something intrinsic." Then I discussed privately with Sonier, which showed some data, showed this very nice muon data as a function with strong magnetic fields, and showing that there is a lot of ordering induced by the magnetic field. And he told me, well, I have examined very, very similar samples as the samples as Cyril Proust has, and I found that they are, you put the magnetic field and bump the magnetic signals, and the things really seems to order. So I think this is very likely that it's some field induced effect. So I was very happy that I was going to manage to make them discuss in the in public, and then I put this, and so this shows what this is a schematic way to represent the results of the group of Proust, that in the underdoped regime they see one small pocket about this area. Well, it may be many, of course, because they don't know if there is one or many. They only know the area, and they know that it's electron doped. It's an electron pocket, sorry, because the magnetization and the Hall resistance are in antiphase. And this is the fact that they are in antiphase is a fingerprint of an electron pocket. In the overdoper regime, instead, they see a large Fermi surface, LDA-like Fermi surface. It didn't work because when they spoke in public, both of them were very very mild about their statement, and so Proust said, well, it may be, we have to check, and Saunier also was not as strong as in private.
So there is a seemingly difference in the data between the data from Proust. I suppose that's the same as Taillefer, right?
Pardon?
That's the same as Louis Taillefer's book, is it?
So this is in Paris. No, sorry, in Toulouse.
Yeah, with Louis.
It's in Toulouse.
Sends all samples to Toulouse.
To Toulouse, okay. So it's the same group.
Yes, you all have.
Yeah, the other is another, the Cambridge group. Mm-hmm. They seem to have some disagreement about the data.
And there's this large population, right? Mm-hmm. The Cambridge group sees that, I think, this group are not seeing.
Mm-hmm. But these are extra stuff that they see.
They both agree on the smaller pocket, mm-hmm. which gives these oscillations.
Mm-hmm. But not the other,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not necessarily disagreement, but that you can see more things.
Disagreement in the sense that in that case, they're not related, they're not, one is not the harmonic of the other.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, it's a stronger case that it's some sort of reconstruction mm-hmm. due to order, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this was not as hot as expected. Then I showed this data, which is the CXN data I told before, which actually was done. The main person involved with this, in this data was Seoul, which now is in China. And the reason, one of my surprise about this data is that people has not along the years tried to go along these lines, which I think are very interesting. I mean, so what is this data? This data is the essentially the momentum distribution function. So what they do is to integrate the spectral function from zero to some higher energy. So they look at some kind of n of k, which is the integral up to some maximum energy of a of k and omega. And the idea is that if you have that in principle one can from this quantity you will be able to localize the Fermi surface because you expect that this quantity has a jump at the Fermi momentum. So you make an intensity map of this quantity and where you see a discontinuity that should be the Fermi surface. And people, so the reason I wanted to show this data and ask CXN about this data is that this data is already 10 years old. And along these 10 years, people, especially people doing photoemission, has criticized a lot this data in the sense that say, we measure there and we don't see these stripy-like Fermi surfaces, but we see large Fermi surfaces, LDA-like, and other quasi-particles. Here there are no other quasi-particles. And which I found actually as a very unfair critics because the way the data is analyzed is very different. And he the remark, and this was also the point of view of CXN, that the way to analyze the data is really different. And so what is the difference? The difference is that here you are emphasizing very much what happened at higher energies, whereas if you look at lower energies, and actually they have another paper, a peer paper, in which they very much emphasize the thing that if you lower this energy window, you start to see nodal quasi-particles. And this doesn't depend on whether you have static stripes or less static stripes. I mean, whether you have neodymium or don't have neodymium. And this is very much consistent with much more recent data. Actually, this is data from Switzerland, in which people, these are not, these are cats at constant energy cats. And at zero energy, you see a kind of nodal quasi-particles and LDA-like Fermi surface. And when you go to larger energies, you start to see these stripy features, which start to resemble very much the the data, the original data by itself. And he agreed that this data is very much compatible with his whole data, and that essentially what happened is that at high energies, you are very much emphasizing the high energy physics in this, and so one can in some sense saying that this is converging to the tunneling data, in a sense that in tunneling you are seeing very much the same thing, that at high energies you have something which looks very much ordered, and when you go to lower energies you start to see nodal quasi-particles and more homogeneous things. So there is very much the belief that there is starting to be convergence between photo emission and tunneling.
Here a little cafe, if you say. Yes, I completely agree with your viewpoint in principle. And when I was at Stanford, I kind of pushed the eggs to take this up again.
Mm-hmm.
And he put a student on it, I forgot the name of the person. And then it was like that they sort of gave up on it, trying to reproduce it, you know, make more of a business out of it, because you can only see the particular polarization direction of the light. And I cannot quite recollect it, but it's a very unnatural one.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was also the initial criticism that it could well be some artifact, right, of the Kopenhagen final state, mm-hmm. effort mm-hmm. you pick up with the polarization of your light.
Yeah. So he,
the reason that there's no real follow-up work.
Well, he told me that the reason there is no follow-up work is that the work was done by Sol, and he didn't want to do it by himself.
Yeah, no, but this was like 2 years ago. See, X had a student on exactly this thing,
mm-hmm.
spending all his free time, mm-hmm. all his energy, on trying.
He told me the reason we didn't follow is that So went to China, and in China he's doing a new laboratory, and he wants him to finish.
You know, I talked hours with his student.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Didn't work fine. It's mm-hmm. a whole lot mm-hmm. of it.
So that's why I wanted, him to say whether he still believes in this data, and he really believes in this data. I mean, he spoke for
CX.
Something like CX, yes.
He took this up and talked about it.
Yeah, he said that, publicly for 10 minutes he was defending this data and saying that the difference between this data and why it's so different is just because the scale of integration is very different. Of course, one simple way to interpret this data is in terms of strong coupling mean field stripes, like you have done many years ago, and one can do that. Usually you got insulating stripes, but one can also get metallic stripes. And if one gets metallic stripes, there is a strong potential here, which because if you have magnetic order, long range magnetic order, because this here the potential changes in the scale of U, and that produces this very flat Fermi surface. Actually, they are not flat, and we have done a calculation with an easy model with using LDA plus U, with these strong coupling stripes, and you see that the actually is not flat, but there is some waving behavior due to the fact that there is transverse hopping processes, and this is very much in accord with the data. I mean, this very much convinces me that this really makes sense, because the periodicity and the amplitude of this waving behavior coincides. So I don't think it's an artifact. I think it's really due to something real.
So this is related to the questions you wanted to discuss. Yeah, sorry, the other side is that when you look at the energy dependence,
yeah.
when the stripes order, it leads to enormous incoherence
mm-hmm.
in terms of energy of the stripes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the momentum space view, and that is the energy axis view.
So in mean field theory you get this. In mean field theory you get this, which agrees very well with this, but you don't get this. I mean, the question is how this came out from. So one thing one can. So here.
The one on the left is AFK.
Pardon?
It's the same thing.
So the you
see. Up above, your, that's.
Yes, it's the same thing as this.
AFK,
okay. 10 of K, yes.
10 of K.
Yes. Well, actually, in mean-field theory, it doesn't make difference because it doesn't make any difference because you don't get the nodal quasi-particles. You just get this flat Fermi surface. I mean, up to zero energy. I mean, in mean-field theory, you get that up to zero energy. So, okay. So my interpretation is that what happened at low energy is that there is some kind of coherence scale, and these magnetic moments actually are fluctuating. And if you are at an energy which is much lower than this fluctuation energy, then you will start to average this strong potential. So it's kind of Kondo physics. At very low energy, if these magnetic moments fluctuate, you will average out this strong bearing potential, and then you will be able to, and electrons will see, sorry, electrons will average over this strongly.
Strong, no, I understand that.
And we'll see something very uniform.
But it is, maybe I didn't get all this in the years past, but I mean, it says that no matter how complicated the time dependence gets, underlying it is a structure.
Pardon?
No matter how
static component.
The static component.
The static component.
It's static. Yeah. In other words, no matter, I mean, it's a little bit, I think, but as we said earlier, is that you can have all the quasi particles, you can have high energy, low energy, whatever.
Yes.
Well, if you take all that out, the underlying spatial structure is simple and doesn't change throughout all of that.
Doesn't change by in time, you mean?
Yeah, well, they make it. The mega part, I mean, the frequency dependence of A, which reflects all kinds of other processes, underlying that is a spatial order.
Yes.
But you're basically saying, it's like, it's not an absolute statement, but when you go up in energy, the effective potential seen by the electrons are kind of growing.
Yes. So at high energies, you see this thing. If you're above, I will show an example. I will show a little example of that, a toy model of that. Okay. Well, this was to show the nodal quasi particles that people see, and this was also to make the comparison with the tunneling data, where you see very similar things, in the sense that at low energies you see something which is very uniform, whereas at high energies you see something which is very inhomogeneous. And this also plotted here, in schematically shown here, in which at low energies you have this nodal state which look very uniform, whereas if you, and then you have this quasi-particle scattered bananas which make this quasi-particle weak scattering, whereas at high energies you see something which is very inhomogeneous. Pardon? No. This is data from this paper from Davis. Okay, so the Davis data. So this is data taken in different points and ordered by the Higer pseudo gap by this energy.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you see that at low energies all of them coincide. Okay, in order to show this convergence between photoemission and tunneling, I also showed this plot here, in which, so this is data by Giazzani, in which he sees this gap, which is a uniform D-wave-like gap close to the nose, and then an anti-node, which is very non-uniform. And well, in photoemission, when it started, although it's not clear whether there is non-uniform. Well, of course, in photoemission you don't see non-uniformity because you are averaging, but you start to see very, very similar forms for the behavior of the gap as a function of the angle.
If you do a calculation with the pair density when you have a uniform D-wave component, it's pretty much the depiction. Mm-hmm. This part, the lower part, being connected with the nodal region. And the other part in the square in the calculation, and that it looks homogeneous.
So, but why is there a kink here?
It's small. Well, it's small, of course. The error bar is
it goes above the D wave.
Yeah.
But the photo emission is looking
in a large area. Tunneling data is looking individually at very small areas. And so it's a little tricky because photo emission is average.
No, I know, but so what Derek did, he did the calculation of this, essentially what would be the spectral function that you will get from ARPES. And if you assume that you have these two gaps, one coming from the uniform D-wave, and the other one coming from the pair of density, they add up in quadrature, and they essentially give you a picture.
Is this data at LDCL?
Yeah.
Yes. This is LDCL.
That's not, right?
Right, the
ones
on the left. That is not,
but this is on the field. Well, I mean, so I just want to, just to follow, are you really suggesting that the spare density is generic to all the qubits?
I don't know. I'm beginning to think that it may be more generic than that. In other words, if you see the layer of the cutting phenomenon, then you have to think that it may be actually more generic than the LDCL. I don't have any, as I said, I don't have any microscopic places.
So Samuels David was there, and he was also very much in accord with Xie Hsien that there is convergence between what they see and what Xie Hsien is seeing.
Convergence in the sense that
at low energies.
Gap.
No, convergence in the sense that at low energies you see things which are Fermi liquid like, or you see quasi particles, and at high energies you see things which look more order like.
And I thought convergence in the sense that near the node, in that region, you saw a superconducting gap.
Yes.
And in the other region, you saw a pseudo gap, and that there were both two gaps.
Yes, and also this block here. I mean, also in this is photoemission, and this is tunneling.
But this is not this field.
Sorry?
This is LDCO data, I think.
This is LDCO.
Yeah,
so
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of systematic, and it looks everywhere about the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Small gap, but
yeah. Okay, so these were possible explanations for another state with stripes. So one was this explanation in terms of glassy physics. There was, of course, also this D-wave-like stripes. I would say that all these are weak coupling stripes in the sense that in order to get nodal states and this kind of physics, you have to put a very weak spin density wave and charge density wave potential. As opposed to the strong coupling stripes I show at the beginning, which you get these flat Fermi surfaces. So that's... So it's more a problem for us working with strong coupling stripes to explain the nodal states than for the people which puts very delicate potentials. Okay, so one possibility, of course, will be phase separation, but that will not work because the Luttinger theorem will not work. You will get you will have a too large density in the Fermi liquid part, and you will realize by the area of the Fermi surface that this doesn't work. And we have thinking about this problem with Marco Grilli and Goetz-Zabel, and we have one toy model and another a bit more elaborate. Well, we are working on that now. I can tell you two words about this. So this model here is a model which doesn't have long range order, but has correlations which are long in time. So we essentially took the idea from Kamp and Schiffer model, which used this a long time ago to work with spin density waves and work try to describe the paramagnetic phase close to a spin density wave instability. So we try to think about that in terms of any order and see how and what. So the idea here is to have a toy model in which one can show that it is possible to have a large Fermi surface at low energy and something which looks much more stripy-like or order-like at higher energy. So this is a model in which if you look at the photoemission, in your final states, you can either have a free electron or you have states in which you create an electron and a boson at momentum at the momentum of the order. So this boson is a kind of soft boson of the system, which when the energy of this boson goes to zero, you have a long range order. And with this toy model, one can show that one gets essentially two branches. One gets a main branch and a shadow branch. Okay, and what one can show very easily is that this shadow branch is always never touches the zero energy. Okay, so if you look at the Fermi surface, you have only one Fermi crossing here. Your Fermi surface looks Fermi liquid like. But if you look at the system, this is older. I think it's not working because otherwise we should do a lot of noise. And in fact, well, this is just the calculation, and you have the real calculation. When you start switch on the mixing between these modes, you get something like this, and your N of K distribution looks like the distribution of an ordered system, okay? But if you look at the Fermi surface, you have only this crossing here. So if you look very close to the Fermi surface, it looks like a Fermi liquid, okay? So this is a system which doesn't have a long-range order. It's just a toy model to show that, in principle, it's possible to have, at low energies, a large Fermi surface, and at high energy, something which looks very much ordered. So this... Okay, I can close here, and I can show you another one with another with the Eliasbar type. Should I?
Anything else that was discussed in the meeting?
Well, I didn't show this interpretation at the meeting. So the discussion at the meeting finished with this, and was what I told before.
Mm-hmm. Jose, was there any discussion of Rice's picture of strong coupling picture of how one got the pockets? Because there is this alternate picture that I know he and co-workers, I should remember their names.
You mean this giant Rice, this analytic form for the...
Yeah, who somehow based on looking at weekly, starting with a two-way ladder, and then imagining weekly coupling and using a phenomenological form and a way for a self-energy. They too have a theory that discusses the formation of the kind of pockets that...
I have not seen that in the conference. Well,
okay, this would be good.
They talk about pockets in a state about without breaking questions of symmetry.
Right.
I believe that theories are inconsistent.
I agree with that too, so defend it.
I don't believe that, but we put that off because Rice will be here and we can have he'll have a discussion with that. Well, I heard the Rice because that's you won't be here. Okay. Well, it's too bad we don't have overlap because it isn't, at least it's out there as another suggested explanation for it that doesn't involve the stripes.
Do you have a quick argument around Subir's objections? It's my intuitive
objection. I think it has to do with where the zeros of the Green's function are as well as where the poles are. And I think it's ultimately tries to show how you do satisfy, in a certain sense, the Luttinger theorem. But
Doug, why would you say it doesn't have anything to do with stripes? Because Fuchun's, and I talked to Fuchun about it, I mean, they started with...
He'll be an expert. They start with ladders, and so you might say those are stripes.
Yeah.
So Fuchun will be here next week.
Good. Great.
That will be perfect. And just we'll have a discussion. But
Fuchun will be here when Berlin is
Fuchun.
Yeah. How long will he be here?
I'm not totally opposed to the idea. I think that picture is incomplete. To get a consistent theory with pockets that don't violate Luttinger theorem, you need a gauge theory, you know, to resonate to it, but they have that. Mm-hmm. And we have, so okay.
Next week, we have some time. We need to have a discussion.
I guess next week I'm supposed to talk at length in this twin theory program. So I don't volunteer to talk. I will be here much longer, so there's other occasions.
I will do so as
well. Now you're kind of scared that I'm mad at you.
No. I just didn't
want to put this talk on the wiki because there's some references I want to get.
Yes, I can put it, sure.
Yeah. Let's do that.
Yeah, I think that's excellent.
So I made a sort of a pneumatic website. We can have another one for stripes if you want to think about
it. Go ahead. We can combine.
Or again, if this could be put on under discussion this Wednesday.